Okay, ladies and gentlemen, if I could ask you to take a seat. We've got a very, very interesting session before us. First, let me say thank you for all of you for coming. Welcome. We're delighted to have you here. There's a lot of news going on these days. Secretary, you're competing with the stock market right now. We'd rather be here, to be candid. I think it's going to be a very interesting afternoon. I've had the privilege of knowing Secretary Guerin for, gee whiz, probably 20 years. I mean, it started when he was Congressman Guerin, and I really admired his willingness to transition over and to take on senior leadership in the administration for the Army, and it came at a very significant time. So I think on behalf of all Americans, Pete, let me say thank you for what you've been doing. We needed your very steady and reassuring leadership during a tough time for the country and tough time for the Army, and you're doing very, very well. And I would just like to say thank you. Thank you to all of you for coming. Let me turn to Ray Dubois. Ray's good offices made this possible. Ray, why don't you lead us through the session this afternoon?
Thank you, John. And thank all of you for coming this afternoon. This opportunity with the Secretary of the Army came about as I was thinking 6 or 7 months ago about the role of the service secretary and the role of the service secretary with respect to his Title 10 responsibilities, organizing, training, and equipping the individual services. I originally had an idea that I'd try to get all three of them here together and compare how they executed their Title 10 responsibilities. Secretary Gates preempted me by firing one of the three service secretaries, as I was reminded when asked by a group of graduate students, what is the real role of a service secretary? I said, it's very simple. It's to get fired, to put yourself out in front if necessary. Pete Guerin, this is special for me because Pete succeeded me as Undersecretary of the Army in February of 2006, and I must confess I was very glad that he did succeed me, number one, because of his background as a four-term congressman, and as a four-year member of the inner circle for Secretary Rumsfeld, therefore knowing the dynamics of OSD, but also equally as importantly, five-plus months as acting Secretary of the Air Force. It is very important, it seems to me, to be effective, either in OSD or in a military department, to have experiences in both. Pete has had those experiences, and we're, as John indicated, we're better for it. A Texan from Fort Worth, he went to the University of Texas and also got his JD from UT. As he indicated, a member of Congress from Fort Worth for four terms, and joined Secretary Rumsfeld and the team a week before September 11th, 2001. Since he succeeded me in February 06, he became then acting Secretary of the Army in March the following year and was sworn in on July 16, 2007. So, again, it is a great pleasure and an honor, Pete, to welcome you to CSIS, and we're looking forward to hearing from you.
Thank you for your kind words. I look around this room and a lot of familiar faces. I see Lloyd Hand in the front row. I guess I go back with Lloyd further than anybody in the room. We were both toiled in the vineyards for Lloyd Benson for many, many years, and it's starting to be a long time ago. What a great leader he was, and I know you and I both consider it a great privilege the time we spent with him. Great to see you here. And other friends, Ray, you talked about what we did together. There are folks in the room that we begin every day at 7 o'clock with, and it's beginning in fall of 2001. Interesting time to be in the Pentagon, interesting time to be in the Department of Defense, and with Pal and Mary Claire and Joe, Leo, it's a look around the room and folks that worked with Bill over these years. Lloyd, our friend Ralph Hall used to tell a story. He said there's three hardest things in the world to do. One is to climb a fence leaning towards you, kiss a girl leaning away from you, and give a speech to a room full of friends. So today I've got that hard task. but I appreciate very much the opportunity to come talk with y'all, and want to thank the CSIS for the invitation to speak today. CSIS has earned a reputation as one of the foremost influencers of public opinion in this country, and not just in this country, but around the world. Some of the most respected leaders in our country have built this institution, work in its ranks, and continue to lead it. And it's a privilege to work to be here for nearly 50 years. Your great work has helped shape the issues of the day and have shaped the public policy for our nation. So CSIS and all of you who are part of that great organization, thank you for the work that you do, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today. Today I want to talk to you about some of the challenges I see for our Army. Pardon me, let me have room up here. Let me see if I can build a little room on this podium. Set that there. Talk to you about some of the challenges I see for our Army in the days and years ahead, and then take your questions and comments, and I look forward to that conversation. I'll begin talking about our first priority, our top priority, our number one challenge, and it's front of mind for everybody that works for the Army every single day. And that's to meet the ever-changing needs of the 140,000 soldiers we have in our harm's way. In the face of the threat of a ruthless, thinking, adaptive, and I think for many people, an underestimated enemy, these needs change from moment to moment, and it's a challenge that will remain our top priority as long as we have a single soldier in harm's way. And not just meet their needs and meet the evolving threats, but anticipate and get ahead of the threats. To meet that challenge requires the commitment of our nation's top scientific and engineering professionals, demands the highest priority of our industrial base, every resource that can effectively be applied to that effort, and an expedited route through and around the bureaucracy that makes getting equipment and innovation to the warfighter a challenge. That's the moral duty of our Army, and it's a moral duty of our nation. And our responses to the demands from theater have done more than meet the needs of soldiers in the field. They've truly transformed our Army over the last 7 years. Our soldiers today are equipped differently, they're trained differently, and led differently than they were 7 years ago. If you stood a fully equipped 2001 combat soldier alongside of a soldier of 2008, you wouldn't recognize them as part of the same Army, except for the flag they wear on their sleeve. And that transformation can never stop. It must evolve as the threat from the enemy evolves. Our National Training Center at Fort Irwin, where generations of soldiers, and I'm sure some sitting here today, battled Krasnovia in artillery and tank battles, it's now the home of Iraqi villages populated by role players, Iraqi nationals, recreating the culture, the languages, the threats, and the environment of Iraq. In theater, the dispersion and pace of decision-making have shaped a new generation of capable, competent, and independent Army leaders. Junior officers and NCOs are making combat, political, economic, and diplomatic judgments that in wars past would have been reserved for leaders well their senior. They're mayors one moment, they're in close combat the next, and as an Army, we must retain these extraordinary leaders. The reorganization of our Army from a division-based structure to modular brigades is nearing completion, with 84% of our brigades currently under a modular design. It's the foundation for our Expeditionary Army that we field today and the most significant reorganization since World War II. We have Secretary Rumsfeld and Pete Schoomaker to thank for that revolution in organizing our Army. Our Army is combat-tested and it's battle-hardened, and today, our Army is without peer. It is the best led, the best trained, and the best equipped Army in the world. And where do we go from here? How do we continue to fight the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and restore the capabilities that, out of necessity, have been neglected, and at the same time build for the future and modernize to ensure that we never send our soldiers into a fair fight? As a nation, we must build and maintain a military that can fight across the entire spectrum of conflict as a nation, from high-end major war to peacekeeping and stability operations, and handle domestic emergencies and international humanitarian crises, and build the civilian capabilities to partner in that effort. As a nation, we must better integrate and project all elements of national power, diplomatic, educational, economic, do a better job of sharing our legal and judicial traditions, and work together with other nations and international organizations if, as a nation, we're going to achieve our strategic objectives. That is easier said than done. 2 weeks ago, I was visiting with a group of soldiers in Afghanistan who are part of the Combined Security Transition Command in Afghanistan. They are part of the effort to build a sustainable Afghan government, a big job. They are training police officers, building a biometric system, constructing civilian ministries, training border and customs agents, among many other assignments. In my meeting with them, I asked them, you know, what kind of help are you getting from the interagency? And they answered me with a blank look, and then they all started laughing. One officer, a colonel, she told me, "Sir, I'm training police officers. I have no background in law enforcement, but sir, I am one enthusiastic amateur, and I am making a difference." And I know she is. But if she had a partner from U.S. law enforcement, she could do it better, and she could do it faster. And this is not to say there aren't courageous and committed representatives from other departments of our government in Iraq and Afghanistan. There are, and many are on the front lines, and they are doing a great job. But they're not enough, and many of their tours are too short for maximum impact. Their agencies are not organized or staffed to support expeditionary operations. It's just a fact. Unlike the military, they are staffed only to meet their current day-to-day missions and not to fill teams for deployment around the world. As a nation, we must develop the capacity to surge all elements of national power, not just the military. Well, let me get back to the Army. What is the role of our Army in this future, and what are our challenges? Many of the challenges facing the Army in the past and present remain our challenges of the future. We will continue to pursue moving and elusive targets. In addition to the immediate demands from theater, there are three specific challenges I'd like to discuss with you today. One, full spectrum readiness for the missions that our nation will ask of our Army. Mastery of the art of strategic communications and making the expeditionary Army work for Army families. I will begin with full spectrum readiness. Recently, Secretary Gates told our Army, "One of the principal challenges the Army faces is to regain its traditional edge at fighting conventional wars while retaining what it has learned and unlearned about unconventional wars." In a recent article in the Atlantic Monthly, Professor Andrew Basevich, a great observer of the modern Army and the issues that we confront, he described a debate for the future of the Army as a conflict between the Crusaders and the Conservatives, between the asymmetric warriors and the conventional warriors. I oversimplify, but he posed the conflict as a strategic choice for the Army, a fork in the road. We cannot choose one or the other. As Dr. Gates has challenged us, as an Army, we must be prepared to do both. Our new doctrine in FM 3.0 requires us to do both. Our nation requires us to do both, and you can be assured that our nation, our president, will in time ask us to do both, and we have to be ready. For 233 years, the Army's charge has been to dominate land operations. Dominate. Well, dominate is a dynamic mission, defined differently in the sands of North Africa in 1942 than in the deserts and cities of Iraq in 2008. And it's defined differently at the same time, but in different places. And defined differently when we consider the threat of near-peer competitors who loom over the horizon, some in a greater number, armed with nuclear capability. Our Army of this century must and will be prepared to dominate across the full spectrum of threats, asymmetric and conventional. We must be an Army that can clear, hold, and build all equally well, win the battle, win the war, win the peace, and build a sustainable peace. In the 21st century, wars may not be won when the enemy's army is defeated on the field of battle. In fact, there may not be a uniform enemy to fight at all. And instead of tanks, they may very well drive white Toyotas. Today, a war may not be won until the conditions spawned that spawned hostilities have been changed. Some call that nation building. That's asking a lot of our soldiers, and frankly not missions that our soldiers sought for themselves, but they are missions that our nation has asked of our soldiers and will in the future. And they are missions that are critical to the safety and freedom to our citizens and to our nation. To dominate land operations means that our soldiers must be trained and equipped for the full spectrum of skills that dynamic assignment requires, symmetric and asymmetric, kinetic and non-kinetic. Today, time is the enemy of full spectrum training. The 12 months between deployments do not allow for family reintegration, training in conventional high-end combat, and preparation for the next deployment in counterinsurgency operations. The growth and rebalancing underway are moving us in the right direction to create that space and that time, but we're not there yet. But we will get there. And the concept of full spectrum will forever be a moving target. In today's conflicts, our soldiers must dominate lethal operations, but be as proficient on a computer keyboard, debating in a village council meeting, recruiting allies among the local population, constructing irrigation systems, and training indigenous forces as they are at delivering precision artillery rounds miles away. We need soldiers who speak foreign languages, understand foreign cultures, and understand and can address the plight of struggling peoples. The Army fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq today has given its own definition to the term dominate. And it is this same army we must retain to be successful in the global war on terror and be prepared for whatever the future holds. The officers and NCOs of today's army, shaped in the complex strategic and tactical environment of Iraq and Afghanistan, understand and have excelled in the gritty reality of what is today's combat environment. We must capture, cultivate, and retain their hard-earned experience and wisdom. Experience and wisdom that must shape our Army's present and our future. In essence, these soldiers have accomplished Army transformation from the ground up. And today, because of their service, sacrifice, and the lessons that they have learned, lived, and applied, we're winning this war. Most of the lessons did not come through or from higher headquarters, but it is the duty of Army leadership to ensure that the men and women who have accomplished this transformation are recognized, promoted, and retained, not because the next war will be the same, but the next war will be different, and the next war will be different. These soldiers, these leaders have demonstrated the ability to learn and adapt on the fly in the middle of a war in a complex and dynamic threat environment. Promotion boards must understand and value the qualities and even the eccentricities of the soldiers who have figured out how to win this war. And if we're going to retain and cultivate the combat edge and the transforming qualities of these soldiers and adapt as the future requires, the Army must be an institution that encourages soldiers to ask hard questions and rewards not only the soldier who risks his life, but the soldier who is willing to risk a career or risk a promotion. We must encourage those who are willing to afflict the comfortable. Recently, Lieutenant Colonel Paul Yingling wrote a piece that I'm sure many of you are familiar with. It appeared in the Armed Forces Journal, and it sparked heated debate throughout the Army. It ruffled some feathers. In fact, it ruffled a lot of feathers. And that's a good thing. We need more, not fewer, Paul Yinglings. And we need an Army culture that promotes a lifetime of learning, questioning, tough questions, and transformation that never stops. Let me talk about strategic communications now. And considering the many factors that will influence success and failure in current and future wars, none is more important than the domain of strategic communications. In a speech at AUSA last year, Secretary Gates recalled a pointed question from a foreign diplomat. How has one man in a cave managed to out-communicate the world's greatest communication society? Good question. Dr. Gates went on to say that speed, agility, and cultural relevance are not terms that come readily to mind when discussing U.S. strategic communications. Well, strategic communications is a weapon of war, and it is old as war. But the proliferation of cheap and powerful technology has given that man in a cave a potent arsenal in the war of ideas, and it's helped level the playing field among first and third world combatants. Anyone with a laptop, a digital camera, and a cell phone has worldwide reach that rivals and often shapes the coverage of the major networks. The enemy has learned to exploit that reach, and our enemy is using strategic communications to kill American soldiers. In the words of Al-Qaeda's al-Zawahiri, more than half this battle is taking place in the battlefield of the media. We must learn to dominate that domain as well as we can operate an Abrams tank. The enemy has a tactical edge. They're unconstrained by the truth. Secretary Rumsfeld told us often that a lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is getting its boots on. We see today how Al-Qaeda can launch a self-serving lie, and often we're playing catch-up against that last lie, and then they launch their next. Now, we as a nation, we as Americans can never retreat from our commitment to the truth. That's a given. But we must cultivate a sense of urgency, proactive and anticipatory, in the information domain comparable to that on the kinetic battlefield when responding to an urgent call from help from an embattled soldier. On the firing range, it's an old idiom, every soldier is a safety officer. Today, in a war of ideas, the wars of this century, everyone in the Army, officer, NCO, enlisted, and civilian, must be a strategic communications officer. We need leaders who understand that the interaction between a single soldier and a local citizen, good or bad, may shape the future of a neighborhood, the future of the region, and change the course of the war. And we must remember that the power of images and actions dwarf the force of the written word, that a YouTube video from a barracks at Fort Bragg can undermine the public's confidence in their army, and that the images from Abu Ghraib remain vivid and shocking long after the words of the most compelling press release are long forgotten. Strategic communications is a complex set of actions, reactions, and counteractions played out in multiple dimensions. The strategic, operational, and tactical run together. At times, it's less important what you say than what you do, and the ability to anticipate what the enemy will say, true or false, about what you've done. We have much to learn in the Army in this domain. At one time, your Army was recognized as the best in the world at strategic communications. In fact, we have an Academy Award to show for it. The Army and Major Frank Capra received the Academy Award for the best documentary in 1942. I brought it with me today. The citation reads, Academy Award to Prelude to War. No, excuse me, Academy Award for Prelude to War. Best documentary feature of 1942 for its trenchant conception and authentic and stirring dramatization of the events which forced our nation into the war and of the ideals for which we fight. This was lost for decades and just recently was recovered. It showed up at a Christie's auction house, and they called the Academy Award and said, well, we've got an Oscar we want to return to you, and then they returned it to the Army. We could use a comparably compelling piece today, and those of you who haven't seen that documentary series anytime lately, I recommend it to you. It is a very compelling piece. We could use the same thing today on the home front. It's an area that really, as an Army, we have neglected. We've, in fact, abandoned. And I doubt if we were as successful as Frank Capra was in 1942 that the Academy would warmly embrace it as it did then. But bottom line, al-Zawahiri is right. The effective Army leader, enlisted, NCO, and Army civilian, must understand and embrace the power of information and communication in the 21st century battle space. My last point, how do we make an expeditionary Army and an almost constantly deployed Army work for Army families? In this year's State of the Union address, President Bush acknowledged the demand on Army families in our Army today, in our Army at war. President Bush told us, our military families also sacrifice for America. They endure sleepless nights and the daily struggle of providing for children while a loved one is serving far from home. we have a responsibility to provide for them. We are a nation long at war, the third longest in our nation's history, and the longest ever fought by an all-volunteer force. In this seventh year of war, soon to be eight, we are in uncharted waters for our soldiers, uncharted waters for our volunteer Army families. The stress on families grows with every deployment. An Army wife told us recently, "You know what? We have combat patches too, but we wear them on our hearts." Just as training and equipping our soldiers adapts to the changing threats, so must support for Army families adapt to their changed circumstances and the increasing demands, physical and emotional, of an Army so long at war. Our volunteer Army, our all-volunteer force, must work for Army families if we're going to hold the all-volunteer force together. And family support cannot depend solely on internal efforts. The support from outside community groups and volunteers will play an increasingly important role in the quality of life for Army families, on post and off. There's no substitute for neighbors helping neighbors, and state and local governments are stepping up and playing an ever-increasing role. Most states now are offering in-state tuition for Army dependents, and most states now also continue it when a family transfers out of state. We have the MSEC, the Military Child Education Committee, Compact, I'm not sure what the C stands for, Patty Shinseki's organization, has done such a wonderful job for military families. They have developed the Interstate Educational Compact, which benefits Army families, Army children, as they move from state to state and from school to school. It became operational this year when 12 states passed it. We must push this initiative until every state that holds an Army active duty soldier has signed on. And the employment and professional expectations and ambitions of spouses of soldiers must be accommodated if we're going to retain the married professionals who are the soldiers of our all-volunteer force. We must renew our commitment to our all-volunteer families daily, and leaders at every level, officer and NCO, soldier and civilian, must work to build an Army that works for Army families. Last weekend, I attended a West Point game. West Point played Texas A&M. And in General Lynch came over from Fort Hood, and he brought 100 wounded warriors with their families. I sat down next to this one wounded warrior and his wife, and they had three kids sitting with him. And they introduced me to their son sitting immediately to their right, and then two other boys. They said, "Well, we're really about adopted these two kids. They're here with us. Their dad's deployed." And I moved over and sat next to one of the boys whose father was deployed. And I said, "Well, I know it must be hard that your dad's gone." And this boy said, "Well, not really. I've gotten used to it." And then the mother of the son who was there said, "He's 6 years old, and his dad's on his third deployment, and this one's 15 years. So the answer, no, not really, I'm used to it, is understandable. But how long is the United States Army going to work for that family? How long can we expect that family to continue to step up and make that kind of sacrifice for our nation? It's a question that we in the Army have to address, and we must do more to ensure that our Army does work for families just like that. We are a nation at war, with the volunteers of our Army, soldiers and families, carrying much of the burden for our free world. Less than 1% of Americans today wear the uniform of our nation's military, about 2.4 million out of a population of 300 million. It's the duty of the remaining 99% to ensure that the debt of the many to the few, the debt of the many to the few soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, and their families is paid in full. Now, your soldiers are busy. Your Army is very busy, and I know you're proud of them. Thank you for letting me have a chance to talk with you today, and I'd be glad to answer your questions, or I'd be glad also to just receive your comments and advice. But again, Ray and John Hamry and officers of CSIS, thank you all for letting me join you today. I appreciate it very much.
Pete. We will now have about 20 or so minutes of Q's and A's. Secretary Guerin has outlined the challenges that our Army faces today in terms of full-spectrum capability and strategic communication in the families. I will take the prerogative of the chair and pose the first question. Mr. Secretary, you referred to Secretary Gates's comment recently about regaining the capability to fight traditional wars, the conventional war capability, but also not forgetting what we have learned in terms of the irregular war, unconventional war, 360 asymmetrical war that we have been executing over the past 4 or 5 years. To what extent do you see an emphasis on one or the other, or to put it in another way, how will the Army move forward and balance, from a resourcing standpoint, these two capabilities that make up, as you referred to, the full spectrum concept?
Our biggest challenge now as far as is regaining that capability in conventional high-end combat operations is time. We've got our brigades coming home, and they're home for 12 months. They are barely home, the 12 months they're home. They go from the initial reintegration with their families, and then they're getting ready to go again. There is not sufficient time in there to train for the full spectrum that full spectrum readiness requires. We are growing the Army, as you know. We're adding 74,500 soldiers to active guard and reserve. We'll have the active duty up to 547,000. We are reorganizing the guard and reserve. They're moving more from a strategic reserve to part of the operational force. We are rebalancing the force, moving people out of low-demand MOSs into high-demand MOSs, moving people so that they can fill deployments. So we are out of balance right now. We expect by 2011 we'll be back in balance. No way we can predict the demand from theater, but with what we see, we expect by 2010, 2011, we'll be in a position to expand the redeployment period, the reintegration period, and be able to start training across the full spectrum. We continue to make investments in the full spectrum of needs. The Future Combat Systems is our number one modernization priority, and it will serve us across the full range of full spectrum of combat needs, and has great relevance. If we had it fully operational today, it would have great relevance to the fight today. In fact, we're trying to expedite the spin out of capabilities, changed our approach and moved from focus on the 15 heavy brigades to the infantry brigades, and moving with a soldier-centric emphasis, moving those capabilities, the network, to the infantry. But in the near term, there's no doubt our weight is shifted to meet the asymmetric threat and the counterinsurgency training. We have the capability to do both. We don't have the time to do both. But lest an enemy think that this provides an opportunity for them, we have other capabilities in our national arsenal, and if we were challenged, and some missions that might have been given to the Army would be given to the Air Force and Navy, they would perhaps do them differently, but they certainly have the power to deliver lethal force on any enemy that might challenge us anywhere in the world.
Thank you. Do we have some questions in the audience? Christine. Do you want to take the mic?
I'm a senior fellow here at CSIS. You mentioned the need to have additional language skills and cultural awareness skills for the Army soldiers. And I'm wondering, given the challenges associated with op tempo, not just for the soldiers themselves, but their families, and in the case of the reserve component, the employers as well, can you talk in a little bit more specific detail about what types of changes you foresee in the future in terms of officer development and education to both acquire the additional diversity of skills, but also do so under a set of pretty serious constraints in terms of time?
the deployment schedule that our soldiers are living with today is making the professional development that we normally were able to fit in comfortably around their deployment schedules, making it a real challenge. And a big emphasis for the chief and me is trying to make that professional development work for the NCO and the officer. But it is a big challenge. We have not rebuilt our professional development and training to keep pace with the demands our soldiers are currently living with the deployment schedules. Issues of language, we've got a number of initiatives to try to incentivize the taking of languages. At West Point, now you have to take 2 years of language unless you're in engineering, you only have to take one. We just started a pilot program for ROTC students where we've identified 7 critical languages, which is a subset of the DOD's strategic languages, emphasis on the languages that are the focus of our areas where we find ourselves in conflict today. But we are, for ROTC students, we're now offering economic incentives to take these critical languages. We also hope that it will help some of the schools that have ROTC programs develop critical language programs. But beginning this fall, we just started the first program, and we expect we'll have about 200 new ROTC cadets in the program. But you get $100 a month for the school year for your first year of a critical language. You get $150 the second year a month, $200, and then $250. And I was just down at A&M and Texas A&M, they only offer Arabic and Chinese. You know, it's one of the biggest programs we have in the country, and those are the only two critical languages that they offer. We also want to incentivize people to take Farsi and Pashtun and Dari, not offered many places. So we're going to have to come up with an approach that not only incentivizes the students to take it, but figure out a way to get some of these schools to start offering programs. But strong emphasis at the OSD level and at the Army level to try to develop greater cultural awareness and try to develop greater language skills. But as far as building the whole educational system around an expeditionary army, that's still a work in progress. And you hear about it wherever you go talking to soldiers. They're doing more remote learning. You know, we've got tuition assistance of $4,500 a year, and a lot of soldiers are going through that entire $4,500 working at night on the internet. But it's one of our challenges is in this era of consistently deployed army, an expeditionary army, we've got to build the professional education system so that it fits in and around the demands on the soldiers. And it's going to be it's going to be a different system.
Thank you. When you have a question, please stand up and wait for the mic and identify yourself. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. My name is Greg Shuckman. I'm from the University of Central Florida, and we partner with PEO STRI, our neighbor, as well as USAMRIID on a number of research projects, so we're very happy to work with the Army. My question to you is actually drawing a little bit on your congressional experience with the Science Committee. What do you see as the research priorities for the Army coming into this new asymmetric warfare?
Mm-hmm. Well, our major research project, we invest in research across a wide range of areas, but our major R&D project are the capabilities associated with future combat systems, and it's a major effort, and we have a ways to go before all of the R&D is completed on that. I'll tell you also an area where we are investing considerable amount in research is in the mental health area. This war with the incidence of post-traumatic stress response, post-traumatic stress syndrome if it's not arrested, and traumatic brain injury, I don't know that we have any higher incidence of PTSD than we had in the past, but we're recognizing it. We understand it's a treatable condition. It's a signature wound, probably of all wars, but it's recognized as a signature wound of this war. And TBI, the primary threat being explosions, what our enemy has used against us, we have unquestionably a higher incidence of traumatic brain injury of varying degrees. And we, with the help of Congress, are putting tens of millions of dollars into research into that area, both inside the Army and outside the Army. We're also in the process of doing a major research project on suicide prevention. Tragically, the suicide rate in the Army has doubled over the last 6 years. And we are doing everything we can to try to identify the symptoms and intercept the situation before it becomes a tragedy. But we also realize how much we have to learn, how much society has to learn. And we have a unique environment. We have a rapid change in the suicide rate within an institution that we know a whole lot about, the people who are committing suicide. If you find somebody committed suicide in an apartment in Chicago, you probably don't know where he was the day before. You don't know who he hung out with. You don't know much about his life. We know a lot about our soldiers. We know what they've done. We know the stresses that they've been under. And we are partnering with the National Institute of Mental Health to do a major research project in that area. But in healthcare, we are making a tremendous investment across a wide range. Injuries that have come from the war, the development of prosthesis for amputees, it's an area where you see dramatic advance. But I think that the area where we are putting a game-changing level of resources is in the mental health area and TBI area. And I'd like to think that a couple of years from now that you'll see not just the Army but the military really as having broken considerable new ground in understanding the pathologies of some of those injuries and the psychology and the treatment of for both TBI and PTSD and really advance the ball.
Thank you. Scott?
Mm-hmm. I'm Scott Badnock from Badnock LLC in Detroit, and my question is about energy independence for the Army. You know, we're at a confluence of an energy problem locally and the problems of getting and fueling an Army that's in the field has got to be daunting, and I'm wondering if there's a consideration for the ability to operate in the future in different fields around the world.
Mm-hmm. We have a renewed interest. Obviously, the high energy prices have caused us to focus with greater intensity on that issue. Last Friday, I signed a charter to create a senior energy executive in the Army and to build a team that will work across the Army, try to break down the stovepipes and do a better job on a number of fronts, help us do a better job in thinking about energy efficiency when we make decisions on acquisitions. You know, do you price and look at the life cycle costs of a some type of a weapon system based on what gas costs at a filling station in Northern Virginia, or do you price what it's going to cost in some remote area in the middle of Afghanistan? Not only the dollar cost, but the challenge of delivering fuel to remote places, and how long can a system operate without a logistical support? FCS, that's one of the issues that's driving the requirements for FCS. But we're also looking at the energy vulnerability of our post camps and stations. In many cases, we, Jim Woolsey has been a part of, and Dr. Schlesinger have been a part of a study recently, which has both a classified and unclassified report, but looked at the vulnerability of us to disruptions of the grid and what it could mean to our Army readiness and our preparedness. So we are looking at ways through generating electricity on post camps and stations, and we'll be announcing some major initiatives in the next couple of weeks so that we will never be independent of the grid, I'm confident, but we can reduce our dependence. We're also looking at ways to recycle waste. We're looking at ways to just better manage our energy resources. Private industry is way ahead of us in the Army as far as just managing the infrastructure from an energy perspective. We have had some initiatives over the last several years. Some have been controversial as far as the actual benefits to the Army. But the private industry has pushed the envelope well beyond where we are as an Army as far as managing the energy efficiency of our installations. And we're going to announce an initiative, a pilot, that we hope will serve to help us learn how better to use our energy resources. One of the simple things is just putting meters in buildings so we can actually track energy use, and that'll be something that a way to judge an installation commander is how well do you do in managing energy. Right now, most of our buildings don't have meters. Our new buildings do. So there's not only are there no incentives for an installation commander to better, or a garrison commander to better use energy resources. In fact, we'd have a hard time measuring it. You could look at the money spent, but of course that varies a lot with energy costs. So it's an area of significant interest, and it's one that I hope that we can give considerable momentum to and pass off an initiative with momentum to the next administration.
Thank you. Yes.
Mr. Secretary, John Riggs, retired Army. Outside of future combat systems, when you kind of look as a outsider at the Army's mm-hmm. budget and POM, you know, it appears that it has a rather subdued investment portfolio. There's very few new starts in the wheeled tracked aviation arena, and that's on top of really what has to be classified as very high usage rates as a result of 7 years of heavy load as far as the war is concerned. Can you just comment on our modernization strategy?
Yeah, well, that's a good point. We future combat system is so much of the modernization future for our Army. We've with the common chassis vehicle, it'll end up replacing vehicles throughout the Army. And that is our major emphasis. We do have other initiatives, the Joint Light Tactical Vehicle, which we're working with the other services on, which is an important part of the plan to replace the Humvees, maybe the MRAPs. The MRAP ended up being a major change in our vehicle inventory that wasn't anticipated a few years ago. We were too late getting it to theater, and there are reasons for that, but the fact is we were. But we're making a multi-billion dollar investment in that. We desperately need a replacement for the Kiowa Warrior. We don't have a open line for that, as you know. We've got the ARH that's in the middle of a Nunn-McCurdy breach. When I was in theater recently and talking with a lot of the helicopter folks over there, they emphasized, pounded the table about that, the importance of getting the Kiowa Warrior replaced. We continue to lose Kiowa Warriors, and they wear out. We will know something about the resolution of the Nunn-McCurdy breach probably early October, next couple of weeks. But that's part of our modernization that we definitely got to get moving ahead. Light utility helicopter is coming on. The moving from Germany to that Mississippi location. So we have, here and there, helicopter initiatives, joint light tactical vehicle initiatives. But so much of the future of the Army is built around the future combat systems. As you know, we've upgraded the tanks considerably. The tank today, even though on the outside it looks the same, is a very different tank. We're stretching the limits of what we can do with the Abrams, but those have continued to be upgraded. But I don't want to make it sound like we're putting all our eggs into a basket, but we're putting a considerable number of eggs in the FCS basket, but it's a basket with very broad application across the whole land domain.
Let me follow on General Riggs' question, Secretary, and it's about the POM, and it's about looking forward in terms of the Army's top line, both in terms of the presidential budget submission as well as the supplemental. I mean, budget is policy in this town, and to what extent do you foresee and can you give us some indication of the resources that will be required to reset and modernize the Army, to acquire and maintain its 500 and nearly 50,000 active component, 350,000 reserve, or at least guard, 200,000 reserves, and, of course, the acquisition of new systems, whether it's under the FCS umbrella or whether it's aviation modernization? Do you anticipate enough resourcing for those multiple requirements?
You all probably saw Chairman Murtha's comments last week, and he talked about the financial, I hate to use the term bailout, sounds negative, but the payment for the financial crisis. And Chairman Murtha has been warning us for years about his concern about the top line it leveling out, if not dropping. I've been worried about that for years. I frankly have been amazed and pleasantly surprised that the Congress has stood with us as they have over these 7 years of war. And I think that reflects the strong support that the American people feel for the military and for servicemen and women, almost on a personal level, even if they don't know them. I saw a poll a couple of months ago that was very disturbing. It said, and this was before 9/11, measuring point, but before 9/11 in 2001, 19% of Americans felt we were spending too much on defense. 19%. This was before 9/11. Now, in the middle of two wars, 50% of Americans feel we're spending too much on defense, according to this poll. Well, that is going to translate into policy at some point. Hadn't yet. In every election that takes place, it starts to slowly shape the Congress with that attitude. I don't know how accurate it is, but it doesn't surprise me. So I think long term, you know, 7 years is long term. 7 years to have consistently growing budgets is extraordinary. But if you look back over our nation's history, and I can look back over the couple of decades or a few decades I've been watching, our defense budgets are sine waves. We always go up and then come down. And we tend to, at the end of every conflict, to draw down the defense budget, spend the money elsewhere. I think that's a real challenge for some of these long-term programs. It's a challenge for FCS. It's a challenge for Joint Light Tactical Vehicle, challenge for these helicopter modernization programs as well. I've been concerned about it for a few years, and I think as an Army, we have to be very concerned about it. And the Chief has started, and it's something that will continue into the next several years, a new enterprise approach to managing the enterprise of the department, and it's modeled after what Vern Clark did with the Navy when he was CNO. We are going to have to learn to do things more cost-effectively and efficiently. I think that we have to assume that in the next few years, I don't know if it's next year or when it will start happening. It may depend upon who's president, but you're going to see pressure on defense budgets. And Pete Kunkel's sitting there at the back. He can give you a chapter and verse. But we can't afford a static defense budget. We just flat can't. And we have our need to modernize, our need to reset, our need to bring on the systems that we have. In the Army, we're mostly people. You know, 75% of our budget goes to people in one form or fashion. Our health care costs continue to go up. We are never successful in getting the Congress to help us at all with TRICARE co-pays. It doesn't surprise me. I'd hate to think where I'd vote if I were over there. But it's we're not doing a very good job of grappling with some of these discretionary costs. And we are at a period of time where not only the Army but the Air Force and the Navy have some very big and expensive weapon systems coming on at the same time. And I think that we have to look at the next 8 or 9 years or 10 years of budgeting involving considerable risk and plan accordingly and take steps to, if the budget is at X level, here's what we'll do. If it's less than that, here's what we'll do to make sure that we don't end up with a bunch of half-done stuff. But with most of our budget going to personnel, we don't have as much flexibility as the other services do.
Thank you. Lloyd.
Mr. Secretary, Lloyd Hand, King and Spalding. With respect to your comment, I noticed the Comptroller General today echoed that same point. My guess is after this week that 50% is probably going to go a little higher in terms of spending too much of defense. I have a different kind of question. At the beginning of your remarks, you rightly identified one of the great strategic assets of this country in terms of projecting power is its military. I believe I read recently where our military capability is probably more powerful than the next 25 countries put together. My question is that given the superiority of the training of our military, do you feel that we are getting the return on the value of that asset in terms of training other allies, both inside and outside of NATO, that we could if we optimize that strategic asset?
Mm-hmm. Well, we face the dilemma of our friends and our allies are disarming. At the same time, our enemies, our potential enemies, are rearming. We really see them both, each of those groups going in opposite directions. You know, NATO, I believe, and there'd be somebody in the room probably knows this better than I think they ask their member nations to spend 2% of their GNP on defense. We spend 4%, roughly 4%. Most of them aren't getting there. France and England are the only two with any ability to project power outside of the immediate European community. The Brits obviously have been a great partner, as have others. Australia has been. But their capabilities are still so small relative to ours. And most of the other NATO countries commit their forces with considerable restraints and strings attached, different rules of engagement. And we have to do the best we can to build coalitions. But I think we have to recognize the limits of what those friends have to offer. We found some new friends that have been of great help, but still when you compare what they're able to bring to the table relative to the challenge and relative to what we do, it's still a very small percentage. We have, this administration over the last several years has pushed the Congress very hard to try to get more authority to train and equip other countries. Georgia, a candidate, one of those candidates where we've been training and equipping there. It's been an interesting dynamic in the Congress that many think, well, that's really a responsibility for the State Department, not the Defense Department. But we've made some success. It was a strong emphasis of Secretary Rumsfeld and also of Dr. Gates. But we run into some resistance in the Congress. But we have to do more than that. Not only is it a force multiplier, but it gives us cultural advantages, language advantages, knowledge of the territory. And it's also a lot cheaper, frankly, to put a Georgian soldier into Iraq than it is to put an American soldier into Iraq with all those other cultural and knowledge of the region advantages. But realistically, you look at who our friends are. Their populations aren't growing. Their defense budgets aren't growing. Their appetite for international engagements is modest relative to the threat, in my opinion. So I think as we look to the future, we've got to redouble our efforts to build coalitions, to train and equip others. But we also just have to be prepared, frankly, to be able to go it alone if we have to. You know, Pal Moore's here and his job in Vienna right now, I think probably has some perspective on it that goes well beyond mine. But you've got this administration, our administration's been criticized for not building coalition that perhaps we could, but you look at the candidates, the potential partners, and if you had them all, it still does not bring the kind of power to the table that the United States can deliver. And what we can do, too, that really no other country can do, we can go and stay. We've got the ability to project force and sustain the force. There's nobody that can match us in that regard. So we're not doing it as the out of the goodness of our hearts. We're doing it to protect American interests, but others benefit, and others have not stepped up as we would expect them to. They've got different politics than we do. It's an area that I think both. I mean, this administration has pushed it hard. Whoever is elected next is going to push it hard. But I think that we have to recognize the limits. We can talk all day about, gosh, wouldn't it be great if we had a lot more partners? But if you added up all the military capabilities of a long list of partners, with the exception of a couple that aren't likely to be our partners, you don't get a whole lot more added to the table. And we end up having to sustain them. We end up having to support them. We end up having to train them. We end up having to feed them. We end up having to, we're the logistical. We're the 800-pound gorilla when it comes to logistics. So I think we shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking that we're ever going to be able to shift much of this burden to others as much as we'd like. But I just don't think it's realistic. And it's our interests we're protecting. They sometimes get a free ride, but chaos in the Middle East, if we prevent it, others benefit, but we certainly benefit, and we can't let it happen just because other beneficiaries refuse to partner.
Thank you very much. We've run over our time. I just want to personally and on behalf of CSIS, thank you very much, Pete. I worked with you for the last 7-plus years. Today's thorough review of Army issues from your point of view doesn't surprise me with your articulateness or your thoughtfulness, and you're dedicated to the soldiers and you're committed to their families. I've never held one of these. This is something special, let me tell you.
If you
and I just
thank the
say,
Academy.
If Frank, what's that?
You have it in your hand, you got to thank the Academy.
I'll thank the Academy, yes. I just want to say that, if Frank Capra hadn't found Jimmy Stewart, he might have selected a young Pete Guerin. Thank you very much. All right.